What about her?
He said, meaning me. Aunt Este said she would take responsibility for me, so he need not concern himself. He gave me a reproachful look. Actually, a filthy look. He knew that I'd tricked him, and that he was now in trouble. But he got into the car and drove out through the gates. The angels were Vidala school angels. They obeyed Aunt Este. Then Aunt Este used her pager to call her own guardian driver, and we got into her car. I'm taking you to a safe place, she said. You must stay there while I talk to your parents. When we get to the safe place, you must promise me you'll eat something. Promise? I won't be hungry, I said. I was still holding back tears. You will be, once you settle in, she said. A glass of warm milk, at any rate. She took my hand and squeezed it. All will be well, she said. All manner of things will be well. Then she let go of my hand and patted it lightly. This was comforting to me as far as it went, but I was on the verge of crying again. Kindness sometimes has that effect. How? I said. How can it ever be well? I don't know, said Aunt Este. But it will be. I have faith. She sighed. Having faith is hard work sometimes. Chapter 38. The sun was setting. The springtime air was filled with the golden haze that can often appear at that time of year, dust or pollen. The leaves of the trees had that glossy sheen, so fresh and newly unfolded, as if they were gifts, each one, unwrapping itself, shaken out for the first time. As if God had just made them, Aunt Este used to tell us during nature appreciation, conjuring up a picture of God waving his hand over the dead-looking winter trees, causing them to sprout and unfurl. Every leaf unique, Aunt Este would add, just like you. It was a beautiful thought. Aunt Este and I were driven through the golden streets. Would I ever see these houses, these trees, these sidewalks again? Empty sidewalks. Quiet streets. Lights were coming on in the houses. Inside there must have been happy people. People who knew where they belonged. Already I felt like an outcast. But I'd cast myself out, so I had no right to feel sorry for myself. Where are we going? I asked Aunt Este. Ardua Hall, she said. You can stay there while I visit your parents. I'd heard Ardua Hall mentioned, always in hushed tones because it was a special place for the aunts. Whatever the aunts did when we weren't looking was not our concern, said Zilla. They kept themselves to themselves, and we should not poke our noses in. But I wouldn't want to be them, Zilla would add. Why not? I asked her once. Nasty business, said Vera, who was running pork through the meat grinder for a pie. They get their hands dirty. So we don't have to, said Zilla mildly, rolling pie crust. They dirty up their minds too, said Rosa, whether they want to or not. She was chopping onions with a large cleaver. Reading. She gave an extra loud chop. I never liked it. I didn't either, said Vera. Who knows what they're forced to dig around in? Filthiness and muck. Better them than us, said Zilla. They can never have husbands, said Rosa. Not that I'd want one myself, but still. Or babies either. They can't have those. They're too old anyway, said Vera. all dried up. The crust's ready, said Zilla. Have we got any celery? Despite this discouraging view of the aunts, I'd been intrigued by the idea of Ardua Hall. Ever since I'd learned that Tabitha wasn't my mother, anything secret had attracted me. When I was younger, I'd ornamented Ardua Hall in my mind, made it enormous, given it magic properties. Surely the location of so much subterranean but ill-understood power must be an imposing construction. Was it a huge castle, or was it more like a jail? Was it like our school? Most likely it had a lot of large brass locks on the doors that only an aunt would be able to open. Where there is an emptiness, the mind will obligingly fill it up. Fear is always at hand to supply any vacancies, as is curiosity. I have had ample experience with both. Do you live there? I asked Aunt Este now. Ardua Hall? All the aunts in this city live there, she said, though we come and go. As the streetlights began to glow, turning the air a dull orange, we reached a gateway in a high red brick wall. The barred iron gate was closed. Our car paused, then the gate swung open. There were floodlights, there were trees. In the distance, a group of men in the dark uniforms of the eyes were standing on a wide stairway in front of a brightly lit brick palace with white pillars. Or it looked like a palace. I was soon to learn it had once been a library. Our car pulled in and stopped, and the driver opened the door, first for Aunt Este, then for me. Thank you, said Aunt Este to him. Please wait here. I'll be back shortly. She took me by the arm, and we walked along the side of a large gray stonework building. Then passed a statue of a woman with some other women posed around her. You didn't usually see statues of women in Gilead, only of men. That is Aunt Lydia, said Aunt Este. Or a statue of her. Was it my imagination, or did Aunt Este give a little curtsy? She's different from real life, I said. I didn't know if Aunt Lydia's visit to me was supposed to be a secret, so I added, I saw her at a funeral. She's not that big. Aunt Este did not answer for a moment. I see in retrospect that it was a difficult question. You don't want to be caught saying that a powerful person is small. No, she said. But statues aren't real people. We turned onto a paved pathway. Along one side of it was a long, three-story building of red brick punctuated by a number of identical doorways, each with a few steps going up to it and a white triangle over the top. Inside the triangle was some writing, which I could not yet read. Nonetheless, I was surprised to see writing in such a public place. This is Ardua Hall, said Aunt Este. I was disappointed. I'd been expecting something much grander. Come in. You will be safe here. Safe? I said. For the moment, she said. And I hope, for some time. She smiled gently. No man is allowed inside without the permission of the aunts. It's a law. You can rest here until I come back. I might be safe from men, I thought. But what about women? Paula could barge in and drag me out, back into a place where there were husbands. Aunt Este led me through a medium-sized room with a sofa. This is the common sitting area. There's a bathroom through that door. She ushered me up a flight of stairs and into a little room with a single bed and a desk. One of the other aunts will bring you a cup of warm milk. Then you should have a nap. Please, don't worry. God has told me it will be all right. I didn't have as much confidence in this as she appeared to, but I felt reassured. She waited until the warm milk arrived, carried in by a silent aunt. Thank you, Aunt Silhouette, she said. The other one nodded and glided out. Aunt Este patted my arm, then left, closing the door behind her. I had only a sip of the milk. I didn't trust it. Would the aunts give me drugs before kidnapping me and delivering me back into Paula's hands? I didn't think Aunt Este would do that, though Aunt Silhouette looked as if she might. The aunts were on the side of the wives, for that's what the girls had said at school. I paced around the small room, then I lay down on the narrow bed. But I was too overwrought to go to sleep, so I got up again. There was a picture on the wall, Aunt Lydia, smiling an inscrutable smile. On the opposite wall was a picture of baby Nicole. They were the same familiar pictures that had been in the classrooms at the Vidala school, and I found them oddly comforting. On the desk, there was a book. I'd thought and done so many forbidden things that day that I was ready to do one more. I went over to the desk and stared down at the book. What was inside it that made it so dangerous to girls like me? So flammable. So ruinous. Chapter 39. I reached out my hand. I picked up the book. I opened the front cover. No flames shot out. There were many white pages inside with a lot of marks on them. They looked like small insects, black, broken insects arranged in lines, like ants. I seemed to know that the marks contained sounds and meaning, but I couldn't remember how. It's really hard at first, said a voice behind me. I hadn't heard the door open. I startled and turned. Becca, I said. I'd last seen her at Aunt Lisa's flower arranging class with blood spurting out of her cut wrist. Her face had been very pale then, and resolved and forlorn. She looked much better now. She was wearing a brown dress, loose on top, belted at the waist. Her hair was parted in the middle and pulled back. My name isn't Becca anymore, she said. I'm Aunt Immortelle now. I'm a supplicant. But you can call me Becca when we're alone. So you didn't get married after all, I said. Aunt Lydia told me you have a higher calling. Yes, she said. I won't have to marry any man ever. But what about you? I heard you're going to marry someone highly important. I'm supposed to, I said. I started to cry. But I can't. I just can't. I wiped my nose on my sleeve. I know, she said. I told them I'd rather die. You must have said the same thing. I nodded. Did you say you had a calling? To be an aunt? I nodded again. Do you really have one? I don't know, I said. Neither do I, said Becca. But I passed the 6-month trial period. After 9 years, when I'm old enough, I can apply for Pearl Girls missionary work, and once I've done that, I'll be a full aunt. Then maybe I'll get a real calling. I'm praying for one. I'd finished crying. What do I have to do to pass the trial? At first you have to wash dishes and scrub floors and clean toilets and help with the laundry and cooking just like Martha's, said Becca. And you have to start learning how to read. Reading's way harder than cleaning toilets. But I can read some now. I handed her the book. Show me, I said. Is this book evil? Is it full of forbidden things the way Aunt Fidala said? This? Said Becca. She smiled. Not this one. It's only the Ardua Hall rule book, with the history, the vows, and the hymns, plus the weekly schedule for the laundry. Go on, read it! I wanted to see if she could really translate the black insect marks into words. Though how would I know they were the right words since I couldn't read them myself? She opened the book. Here it is, on the first page. Ardua Hall. Theory and Practice. Protocols and Procedures. Per Ardua cum Estris. She showed me. See this? It's an A. What's an A? She sighed. We can't do this today because I have to go to the Hildegard Library. I'm on night duty, but I promise I'll help you later if they let you stay. We can ask Aunt Lydia if you can live here, with me. There are 2 bedrooms empty. Do you think she'll allow it? I'm not sure, said Becca, lowering her voice. But don't ever say anything bad about her, even if you think you're in a safe place such as here. She has ways of knowing about it, she whispered. She is truly the scariest one of all the aunts. Scarier than Aunt Fidala? I whispered back. Aunt Fidala wants you to make mistakes, said Becca. But Aunt Lydia, it's hard to describe. You get the feeling she wants you to be better than you are. That sounds inspirational, I said. Inspirational was a favorite word of Aunt Lise's. She used it for flower arrangements. She looks at you as if she really sees you. So many people had looked past me. I think I'd like that, I said. No, said Becca. That's why she's so scary. Chapter 40. Paula came to Ardua Hall to try to get me to change my mind. Aunt Lydia said it was only proper that I should meet with her and assure her in person of the rightness and holiness of my decision. So I did. Paula was waiting for me at a pink table in the Schlafly Cafe, where we at Ardua Hall were permitted to receive visitors. She was very angry.
Have you no idea of the trouble your father and I went to in order to secure the connection with Commander Judd? She said. You have dishonored your father.
Membership in the aunts is far from dishonorable, I said piously. I had a call to higher service. I could not refuse it.
You're lying, said Paula. You're not the kind of girl God would ever single out. I demand that you return home immediately.
I stood up suddenly and smashed my teacup on the floor.
How dare you question the divine will?
I said. I was almost shouting.
Your sin will find you out.
I didn't know what sin I meant, but everyone has a sin of some kind.
Act crazy, Becca had told me.
Then they won't want you marrying anyone. It will be their responsibility if you do anything violent. Paula was taken aback. For a moment, she had no answer, but then she said,
The aunts need Commander Kyle's agreement, and he will never give it. So pack up, because you're leaving now.
At that moment, however, Aunt Lydia came into the cafe. May I have a word with you? She said to Paula. The two of them moved to a table at some distance from me. I strained to hear what Aunt Lydia was saying, but I could not. When Paula stood up, however, she looked sick. She left the cafe without a word to me, And later that afternoon, Commander Kyle signed the formal permission granting authority over me to the aunts. It was many years before I was to learn what Aunt Lydia had said to Paula to force her to relinquish me. Next, I had to go through the interviews with the founding aunts. Becca had advised me on the best way to behave with each of them. Aunt Elizabeth went in for dedication to the greater good. Aunt Helena would want to get it over quickly. But Aunt Vidala liked groveling and self-humiliation. So I was prepared. The first interview was with Aunt Elizabeth. She asked whether I was against marriage or just against marriage to Commander Judd. I said I was against it in general, which seemed to please her. Had I considered how my decision might hurt Commander Judd? Hurt his feelings? I almost said that Commander Judd didn't seem to have any feelings, but Becca had warned me not to say anything disrespectful because the aunts wouldn't put up with it. I said I'd prayed for the emotional well-being of Commander Judd, and he deserved every happiness, which I was positive some other wife would bring him. But divine guidance had told me I would not be able to provide that sort of happiness for him, or indeed for any man, and I wanted to consecrate myself in service to all the women of Gilead rather than to one man and one family. If you really mean that, you are well positioned spiritually to get on very well here at Ardua Hall, she said. I will vote for your conditional acceptance. After 6 months, we will see whether this life is truly the path you have been chosen to follow. I thanked her repeatedly and said how grateful I was, and she appeared to be pleased. My interview with Aunt Helena was nothing much. She was writing in her notebook and did not look up. She said that Aunt Lydia had already made up her mind, so of course she would have to agree. She implied I was boring and a waste of her time. My interview with Aunt Vidala was the most difficult. She'd been one of my teachers and she hadn't liked me then. She said I was shirking my duty, and any girl who'd been gifted with a woman's body was obligated to offer this body up in holy sacrifice to God and for the glory of Gilead and mankind, and also to fulfill the function that such bodies had inherited from the moment of creation, and that was nature's law. I said that God had given women other gifts as well, such as the ones he had bestowed on her. She said, "What might those be?" I said, "The gift of being able to read, since all aunts were gifted in that way." She said that the reading the aunts did was holy reading, and in the service of all the things she had said before. She said them over again. And did I presume to be sufficiently sanctified myself? I said I was willing to do any kind of hard work in order to become an aunt like her, because she was a shining example, and I wasn't yet sanctified at all. But perhaps through grace and prayer, I would receive enough sanctification, though I could never hope to achieve the level of sanctification that she herself had reached. Aunt Vidala said I was displaying an appropriate meekness, which boded well for a successful integration into the service community of Ardua Hall. She even gave me one of her pinched-in smiles before I left. My final interview was with Aunt Lydia. I'd been anxious about the others, but as I stood outside the door to Aunt Lydia's office, I was terrified. What if she'd thought better of it? She had a reputation for being not only fearsome, but unpredictable. While I was lifting my hand to knock, her voice came from inside. "Don't stand there all day. Come in." Was she looking at me through a miniature hidden camera? Becca had told me that she deployed a lot of those, or that was the rumor. As I was soon to discover, Ardua Hall was an echo chamber. The rumors fed back into one another so you could never be certain where they had come from. I entered the office. Aunt Lydia was sitting behind her desk, which was stacked high with file folders. "Agnes," she said, "I must congratulate you. Despite many obstacles, you have succeeded in making your way here and have answered the call to join us." I nodded. I was afraid she would ask me what that call had been like. Had I heard a voice? But she did not. "You are very positive that you do not wish to marry Commander Judd?" I shook my head for no. "Wise choice," she said. "What?" I was surprised. I'd thought she might give me a moral lecturing about the true duties of women or something of the sort. I mean, pardon? "I am sure you would not have made him a fitting wife." I breathed out in relief. "No, Aunt Lydia," I said. "I would not. I hope he will not be too disappointed. I have already proposed a more appropriate choice for him," she said. "Your former schoolmate, Shunammite." "Shunammite?" I said. "But she's going to marry someone else."
"These arrangements can always be altered. Would Shunammite welcome the change of husbands, do you think?"
I remembered Shunammite's barely concealed envy of me and her excitement over the material advantages her wedding would bring. Commander Judd would confer 10 times as many of those. "I am sure she would be deeply grateful," I said.
"I agree."
She smiled. It was like an old turnip smiling, the dried-up kind our Marthas used to put in soup stock. "Welcome to Ardua Hall," she continued. "You have been accepted. I hope you are grateful for the opportunity and for the help I have given you."
"I am, Aunt Lydia," I managed to get out. "I am truly grateful."
"I am glad to hear it," she said. "Perhaps one day you will be able to help me as you yourself have been helped. Good should be repaid with good. That is one of our rules of thumb here at Ardua Hall."
Part 15. Fox and Cat.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 41. All things come to she who waits. Time wounds, all heals. Patience is a virtue. Vengeance is mine. These hoary chestnuts are not always true, but they are sometimes true. Here's one that is always true. Everything's in the timing, like jokes. Not that we have many jokes around here. We would not wish to be accused of bad taste or frivolity. In a hierarchy of the powerful, the only ones allowed to make jokes are those at the top, and they do so in private. But to the point. It has been so crucial for my own mental development to have had the privilege of being a fly on the wall, or, to be more exact, an ear inside the wall. So instructive. The confidences shared by young women when they believe no third party is listening. Over the years, I increased the sensitivity of my microphones. I attuned them to whispers. I held my breath to see which of our newly recruited girls would provide me with the sort of shameful information I both craved and collected. Gradually, my dossiers filled up, like a hot air balloon getting ready for liftoff. In the matter of Becca, it took years. She'd always been so reticent about the primary cause of her distress, even to her school friend, Agnes. I had to wait for sufficient trust to develop. It was Agnes who finally broached the question. I used their earlier names here, Agnes, Becca, since it was these names they used among themselves. Their transformation into perfect aunts was far from complete, which pleased me. But then, no one's ears when push comes to shove. "Becca, what really happened to you?" Agnes said one day when they were engaged in their Bible studies. "To make you so set against marriage." Silence. "I know there was something. Please, wouldn't you like to share it with me?" "I can't say." "You can trust me. I won't tell." Then, in bits and pieces, it came out. The wretched Dr. Grove had not stopped at the fondling of his young patients in the dentist's chair. I had known about this for some time. I had even collected photographic evidence, but I had passed over it since the testimonies of young girls, if testimonies can be extracted from them, which in this case I doubted, would count for little or nothing. Even with grown women, four female witnesses are the equivalent of one male here in Gilead. Grove had depended on that. Also, the man had the confidence of the commanders. He was an excellent dentist, and much latitude is given by those in power to professionals who can relieve them of pain. The doctors, the dentists, the lawyers, the accountants. In the new world of Gilead, as in the old, their sins are frequently forgiven them. But what Grove had done to the young Becca, the very young Becca, and then the older but still young Becca, that to my mind demanded retribution. Becca herself could not be relied upon to exact it. She would not testify against Grove, of that I was certain. Her conversation with Agnes confirmed this. "Agnes, we have to tell someone." Becca, "No, there's no one." Agnes, "We could tell Aunt Lydia." Becca, "She'd say he was my parent and we should obey our parents. It's God's plan. That's what my father said himself." Agnes, "But he isn't your parent, really. Not if he did that to you. You were stolen from your mother. You were handed over as a baby." Becca, "He said he was set in authority over me by God." Agnes, "What about your so-called mother?" Becca, "She wouldn't believe me. Even if she did, she'd say I led him on. They'd all say that." Agnes, "But you were four." Becca, "They'd say it anyway. You know they would. They can't start taking the word of people like me. And suppose they did believe me, he'd be killed. He'd be ripped apart by the handmaids at a participation, and it would be my fault. I couldn't live with that. It would be like murder." I haven't added the tears, the comfortings by Agnes, the vows of eternal friendship, the prayers. But they were there. It was enough to melt the hardest heart. It almost melted mine. The upshot was that Becca had decided to offer up this silent suffering of hers as a sacrifice to God. I am not sure what God thought of this, but it did not do the trick for me. Once a judge, always a judge. I judged, I pronounced the sentence. But how to carry it out? After pondering for some time, I decided last week to make my move. I invited Aunt Elizabeth for a cup of mint tea at the Schlafly Café. She was all smiles. She had been singled out for my favor. "Aunt Lydia," she said, "this is an unexpected pleasure." She had very good manners when she chose to use them. Once a Vassar girl, always a Vassar girl, as I sometimes said snidely to myself, while watching her beating to a pulp the feet of some recalcitrant handmaid prospect in the Rachel and Leah Center. "I thought we should have a confidential talk," I said. She leaned forward, expecting gossip. "I'm all ears," she said. An untruth. Her ears were a small part of her, but I let that pass. "I've often wondered," I said, "if you were an animal, what animal would you be?" She leaned back, puzzled. "I can't say I've given it any thought," she said, "since God did not make me an animal." "Indulge me," I said. "For instance, fox or cat?" Here, my reader, I owe you an explanation. As a child, I'd read a book called Aesop's Fables. I'd got it from the school library. My family did not spend money on books. In this book was a story I have often meditated upon. Here it is. Fox and Cat were discussing their respective ways of evading the hunters and their dogs. Fox said he had a whole bag of tricks, and if the hunters came with their dogs, he would employ them one by one, doubling back on his own tracks, running through water to destroy his scent, diving into a den with several exits. The hunters would be worn out by Fox's cleverness and would give up, leaving Fox to continue his career of theft and barnyard muggings. "And what about you, dear Cat?" he asked. "What are your tricks?" "I have only one trick," Cat replied. "When in extremis, I know how to climb a tree." Fox thanked Cat for the entertaining preprandial conversation and declared that it was now dinner time and Cat was on the menu. Snapping a fox teeth, clumps of cat fur. A name tag was spat out. Posters of missing Cat were stapled to telephone poles, with heartfelt pleas from woebegone children. Sorry, I get carried away. The fable continues as follows. The hunters and their dogs arrive on the scene. Fox tries all his tricks, but he runs out of ruses and is killed. Cat, meanwhile, has climbed a tree and is watching the scene with equanimity. "Not so clever after all," she jeers, or some such mean-spirited remark. In the early days of Gilead, I used to ask myself whether I was fox or cat. Should I twist and turn, using the secrets in my possession to manipulate others? Or should I zip my lip and rejoice as others outsmarted themselves? Obviously, I was both, since, unlike many, here I still am. I still have a bag of tricks, and I'm still high in the tree. But Aunt Elizabeth knew nothing of my private musings. "I honestly don't know," she said. "Maybe a cat." "Yes," I said, "I have pegged you as a cat. But now perhaps you must draw upon your inner fox." I paused. "Aunt Fadala is attempting to incriminate you," I continued. "She claims that you are accusing me of heresy and idolatry by planting eggs and oranges on my own statue." Aunt Elizabeth was distraught. "That is untrue. Why would Vidala say that? I have never harmed her." "Who can fathom the secrets of the human soul?" I said. "None of us is exempt from sin. Aunt Vidala is ambitious. She may have detected that you are de facto second in command to me." Here Elizabeth brightened, as this was news to her. "She will have deduced that you are thus next in the line of succession here at Ardua Hall. She must resent this, as she considers herself your senior, and indeed mine, having been an early believer in Gilead. I am not young, nor in the best of health. She must feel that, in order to claim her rightful position, it is necessary to eliminate you. Hence her desire for new rules outlawing the offerings at my statue. With punishments," I added. "She must be angling for my expulsion from the aunts and for yours as well." Elizabeth was weeping by now.
"How could she be so vindictive?" she sobbed. "I thought we were friends."
"Friendship, alas, can be skin deep. Don't worry. I will protect you."
"I'm immensely grateful, Aunt Lydia. You have such integrity."
"Thank you," I said. "But there is one little thing I want you to do for me in return."
"Oh, yes, of course," she said. "What is it?"
"I want you to bear false witness," I said. This was not a trivial request. Elizabeth would be risking much. Gilead takes a stern view of bearing false witness, though it is nonetheless done frequently.
Part 16. Pearl Girls.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369B. Chapter 42. My first day as the runaway Jade was a Thursday. Melanie used to say that I was born on a Thursday, and that meant I had far to go. This was an old nursery rhyme that also says Wednesday's child is full of woe. So when I was feeling grumpy, I'd say she got the day wrong, and it was really Wednesday. And she would say, no, of course not. She knew exactly when I was born. How could she ever forget it? Anyway, it was a Thursday. I was sitting cross-legged on the sidewalk with Garth, wearing black tights with a rip in them. Ada had supplied them, but I had made the rip myself, and magenta shorts over them, and worn-out silver gel shoes that looked as if they'd been through the digestive system of a raccoon. I had a dingy pink top. It was sleeveless because Ada said I should display my new tattoo. I had a gray hoodie tied around my waist and a black baseball cap. None of the clothes fit. They had to look as if I'd grabbed them out of dump bins. I dirtied up my new green hair to give the impression that I'd been sleeping rough. The green was already fading. You look amazing, said Garth once he saw me in the full costume and ready to go. Amazingly like shit, I said. Great shit, said Garth. I thought he was only trying to be nice to me, and I resented that. I wanted him to actually mean it. But once you're in Gilead, you really have to cut the swearing. Maybe even let them convert you out of it. There were a lot of instructions to remember. I was feeling nervous. I was sure I would mess up. But Garth said just act stupid, and I'd said thanks for saying act. I wasn't very good at flirting. I'd never done it before. The two of us were set up outside a bank, which Garth said was a prime location if you were angling for free cash. People coming out of banks are more likely to give you some. Another person, a woman in a wheelchair, usually had this space, but Mayday had paid her to relocate for as long as we needed it. The Pearl Girls had a route they followed, and our spot was on it. The sun was blazing, so we were backed against the wall, in a little slice of shade. I had an old straw hat in front of me with a cardboard sign in crayon. Homeless, please help. There were a few coins in the hat. Garth said that if people saw someone else had put money in, they'd be more likely to do it themselves. I was supposed to be acting lost and disoriented, which wasn't hard to do since I really felt that way. A block to the east, George was set up on another corner. He'd call Ada and Elijah if there was any trouble, either with the Pearl Girls or the police. They were in a van, cruising the area. Garth didn't talk much. I decided he was a cross between a babysitter and a bodyguard. So he wasn't there to make conversation, and there was no rule that said he had to be nice to me. He was wearing a black sleeveless t-shirt that showed his own tattoos, a squid on one biceps, a bat on the other, both of them in black. He had one of those knitted caps, also in black. Smile at the people if they toss in, he said after I'd failed to do this for a white-haired old lady. Say something. Like what? I asked. Some people say, God bless you. Neil would have been shocked if I'd ever said such a thing. That would be a lie, if I don't believe in God.
Okay, then. Thanks, will do, he said patiently. Or, have a nice day.
I can't say those, I said. It's hypocritical. I don't feel thankful, and I don't care what kind of an asshole day they have. He laughed.
Now you're worried about lying? Then why not change your name back to Nicole?
It's not my name of choice. It's bottom of the freaking list, you know that. I crossed my arms on my knees and turned away from him. I was getting more childish by the minute. He brought it out in me.
Don't waste your anger on me, said Garth. I'm just furniture. Save it for Gilead.
You all said I had to have attitude, so this is my attitude.
Here come the Pearl Girls, he said. Don't stare at them. Don't even see them. Act like you're stoned.
I don't know how he'd spotted them without seeming to look. They were way down the street. But soon they were level with us.
two of them in their silvery gray dresses with long skirts, their white collars, their white hats. A redhead from the wisps of her hair that were showing, and a brunette, judging from the eyebrows. They smiled down on me where I sat against the wall.
"Good morning, dear," the redhead said. "What's your name?"
"We can help you," said the brunette. "No homeless in Gilead." I gazed up at her, hoping I looked as woeful as I felt. They were both so prim and groomed, they made me feel triple grubby. Garth put his hand on my right arm, gripped it possessively. "She's not talking to you," he said.
"Isn't that up to her?" said the redhead.
I looked sideways at Garth as if asking for permission.
"What's that on your arm?"
said the taller one, the brunette. She peered down.
"Is he abusing you, dear?"
the redhead asked. The other one smiled.
"Is he selling you? We can make things so much better for you."
"Fuck off, Gilead bitches," Garth said with impressive savagery. I looked up at the two of them, neat and clean in their pearly dresses and their white necklaces. And believe it or not, a tear rolled down my cheek. I knew they had an agenda and didn't give a shit about me. They just wanted to collect me and add me to their quota. But their kindness made me go a little wobbly. I wanted to have someone lift me up, then tuck me in.
"Oh my," said the redhead. "A real hero. At least let her take this."
She thrust a brochure at me. It said, "There is a home in Gilead for you."
"God bless."
The two of them left, glancing back once.
"Wasn't I supposed to let them pick me up?" I said. "Shouldn't I go with them?"
"Not the first time. We can't make it too easy for them," said Garth. "If anyone's watching from Gilead, it would be too suspicious. Don't worry. They'll be back." Chapter 43. That night we slept under a bridge. It crossed a ravine with a creek at the bottom. A mist was rising. After the hot day, it was chilly and damp. The earth stank of cat piss, or maybe a skunk. I put on the gray hoodie, easing the arm down over my tattoo scar. It was still a little painful. There were four or five others under the bridge with us. Three men and two women, I think, though it was dark and it was hard to tell. George was one of the men. He acted as if he didn't know us. One of the women offered cigarettes, but I knew better than to try to smoke one. I would cough and give myself away. A bottle was being passed around, too. Garth had told me not to smoke or drink anything, because who knew what might be in it. He'd also told me not to talk to anyone. Any of these people could be a Gilead plant, and if they tried to ferret out my story and I slipped up, they'd smell a rat and warn the Pearl Girls. He did the talking, which was mostly grunts. He seemed to know a couple of them. One of them said, "What is she, retarded? How come she doesn't talk?" And Garth said, "She only talks to me." And the other one said, "Nice work. What's your secret?" We had several green plastic garbage bags to lie down on. Garth wrapped his arms around me, which made it warmer. At first I pushed his top arm away, but he whispered into my ear, "Remember, you're my girlfriend." So I stopped wriggling. I knew his hug was acting, but at that moment I didn't care. I really did feel almost as if he was my first boyfriend. It wasn't much, but it was something. The next night, Garth got into a fight with one of the men under the bridge. It was a quick fight, and Garth won. I didn't see how. It was a short, swift move. Then he said we should relocate, so the next night we slept inside a downtown church. He had a key. I don't know where he got it. We weren't the only people sleeping in there. Judging by the junk and crap under the pews, discarded backpacks, empty bottles, the odd needle.
We ate in fast food places, which cured me of junk food. I used to think it was slightly glamorous, probably because Melanie disapproved of it. But if you eat it all the time, you get a sickly, bloated feeling. That's also where I went to the washroom, in the daytime, when I wasn't squatting in one of the ravines. The fourth night was a cemetery. Cemeteries were good, said Garth, but there were often too many people in them. Some of them thought it was entertaining to jump up at you from behind a tombstone, but those were just kids running away from home for the weekend. The street people knew that scaring someone like that in the dark was likely to get you knifed, because not everyone roaming in cemeteries was completely stable. Such as you, I said. He didn't react. I was probably getting on his nerves. I should mention here that Garth didn't take advantage, even though he must have realized that I had a puppy love crush on him. He was there to protect me, and he did, including protecting me from himself. I like to think he found that hard. Chapter 44. When are the Pearl Girls going to show up again? I asked, on the morning of the fifth day. Maybe they've rejected me. Be patient, said Garth. As Ada said, we've sent people into Gilead this way before. Some of them made it in, but a couple were too eager. They let themselves be scooped on the first pass. They got flushed before they even crossed the border. Thanks, I said dolefully. That makes me feel confident. I'm going to screw this up. I know it. Keep cool. You'll be fine, said Garth. You can do it. We're all counting on you. No pressure, right? I said. You say jump, I say how high. I was being a pain, but I couldn't stop myself. Later that same day, the Pearl Girls came our way again. They loitered around, passing by, then crossed the street and walked in the other direction, looking in store windows. Then, when Garth went off to get us some burgers, they came over and started talking to me. They asked what my name was, and I said Jade. Then they introduced themselves. Aunt Beatrice was the brunette. Aunt Dove was the freckled redhead. They asked if I was happy, and I shook my head no. Then they looked at my tattoo and said I was a very special person to have undergone all that suffering for God, and they were glad I knew God cherished me. And Gilead would cherish me too, because I was a precious flower. Every woman was a precious flower, and especially every girl of my age. And if I was in Gilead, I would be treated like the special girl I was, and protected. And no one, no man, would ever be able to hurt me. And did that man who was with me, did he hit me? I hated to lie about Garth like that, but I nodded. And does he make you do bad things? I looked stupid, so Aunt Beatrice, the taller one, said, does he make you have sex? I gave the tiniest nod, as if I was ashamed of those things. And does he pass you around to other men? That was going too far. I couldn't imagine Garth doing anything like that, so I shook my head no. And Aunt Beatrice said maybe he hadn't tried that yet, but if I stayed with him, he would, because that's what men like him did. They got hold of young girls and pretended to love them, but soon enough, they were selling them to whoever would pay. Free love, Aunt Beatrice said scornfully. It's never free. There's always a price. It's never even love, said Aunt Dove. Why are you with him? I didn't know where else to go, I said, and burst into tears. There was violence at home. There is never violence in our homes in Gilead, said Aunt Beatrice. Then Garth came back and acted angry. He grabbed my arm, the left one, with the scarification on it, and pulled me to my feet, and I screamed because it hurt. He told me to shut up and said we were going. Aunt Beatrice said, could I have a word with you? She and Garth moved away out of hearing, and Aunt Dove handed me a tissue because I was crying and said, May I hug you on behalf of God? And I nodded.
Aunt Beatrice came back and said,
We can go now.
And Aunt Dove said,
Praise be.
Garth had walked away. He didn't even look back. I didn't get to say goodbye to him, which made me cry more.
It's all right. You're safe now, said Aunt Dove. Be strong.
Which was the kind of thing the refugee women from Gilead were told at Sanctucare, except that they were going in the other direction. Aunt Beatrice and Aunt Dove walked very close to me, one on either side, so nobody would bother me, they said.
That young man sold you, said Aunt Dove with contempt.
He did? I asked. Garth hadn't told me he'd intended to do that.
All I had to do was ask. That's how much he valued you. You're lucky he sold you to us and not some sex ring, said Aunt Beatrice. He wanted a lot of money, but I got him down. In the end, he took half.
Filthy infidel, said Aunt Dove.
He said you were a virgin, which would make your price higher, said Aunt Beatrice. But that's not what you told us, is it?
I thought fast.
I wanted you to feel sorry for me, I whispered, so you would take me with you.
The two of them glanced at each other, across me.
We understand, said Aunt Dove, but from now on, you must tell the truth.
I nodded and said I would. They took me back to the condo where they were staying. I wondered whether it was the same condo that the dead Pearl Girl had been found in. But my plan right then was to say as little as possible. I didn't want to blow it. I also didn't want to be found attached to a doorknob. The condo was very modern. It had two bathrooms, each with a bathtub and a shower, and huge glass windows, and a big balcony with real trees growing on it in concrete planters. I soon found out that the door to the balcony was locked. I was dying to get into the shower. I reeked of my own layers of dirty skin flakes and sweat and feet in old socks, and the stinky mud under the bridge, and the frying fat smell of the fast food places. The condo was so clean and filled with citrus air freshener that I thought my smell must really stand out. When Aunt Beatrice asked if I wanted a shower, I nodded quickly. But I should be careful, said Aunt Dove, because of my arm. I shouldn't get it wet because the scabs might come off. I must admit I was touched by their concern. Phony though it was, they didn't want to take a festering mess to Gilead instead of a pearl. When I came out of the shower, wrapped up in a white fluffy towel, my old clothes were gone. They were so filthy there was no point in even washing them, said Aunt Beatrice, and they laid out a silvery gray dress just like theirs.
I'm supposed to wear this, I said, but I'm not a Pearl Girl. I thought the Pearl Girls were you.
The ones who gather the pearls and the pearls who are gathered are all pearls, said Aunt Dove. You are a precious pearl, a pearl of great price.
That's why we've gone to such risks for you, said Aunt Beatrice. We have so many enemies here. But don't worry, Jade. We'll keep you safe.
In any case, she said, even though I wasn't an official Pearl Girl, I would need to wear the dress in order to get out of Canada because the Canadian authorities were clamping down on the export of underage converts. They were viewing it as human trafficking, which was quite wrong of them, she added. Then Aunt Dove reminded her that she should not use the word export, as girls were not commodities, and Aunt Beatrice apologized and said she had meant to say the facilitating of cross-border movement, and they both smiled.
I'm not underage, I said. I'm 16. Do you have any identification?
Aunt Beatrice asked. I shook my head no.
We didn't think so, said Aunt Dove. So we will arrange that for you.
But to avoid any problems, you'll have papers identifying you as Aunt Dove, said Aunt Beatrice. The Canadians know she came in, so when you cross the border, they'll think you are her. But I'm a lot younger, I said. I don't look like her. Your papers will have your picture, said Aunt Beatrice. The real Aunt Dove, she said, would stay in Canada and leave with the next girl who was gathered, taking the name of an incoming Pearl girl. They were used to switching around like that.
The Canadians can't tell us apart, said Aunt Dove. We all look the same to them.
Both of them laughed, as if they were delighted at having played such pranks. Then Aunt Dove said that the most important extra reason for wearing the silvery dress was to smooth my entrance into Gilead, because women didn't wear men's clothing there. I said leggings weren't men's clothing, and they said, calmly but firmly, that yes, they were, and it was in the Bible. They were an abomination, and if I wanted to join Gilead, I would have to accept that. I reminded myself not to argue with them, so I put on the dress, also the pearl necklace, which was fake, just as Melanie had said. There was a white sun hat, but I only needed to put it on to go outside, they said. Hair was permitted inside a dwelling, unless there were men around, because men had a thing about hair. It made them spin out of control, they said. And my hair was particularly inflammatory, because it was greenish.
It's only a tint. It'll wear off, I said apologetically, so they'd know I'd already renounced my rash hair color choice. It's all right, dear, said Aunt Dove. No one will see it.
The dress actually felt quite good after my dirty old clothes. It was cool and silky. Aunt Beatrice ordered in pizza for lunch, which we had with ice cream from their freezer. I said I was surprised that they were eating junk food. Wasn't Gilead against it, especially for women?
It's part of our test as Pearl Girls, said Aunt Dove. We're supposed to sample the fleshpot temptations of the outside world in order to understand them, and then reject them in our hearts.
She took another bite of pizza.
Anyway, it will be my last chance to try them, said Aunt Beatrice,
who had finished off the pizza and was eating her ice cream.
I honestly don't see what's wrong with ice cream, as long as it has no chemicals.
Aunt Dove gave her a reproachful look. Aunt Beatrice licked her spoon. I said no to the ice cream. I was too nervous. Also, I no longer liked it. It reminded me too much of Melanie. That night before going to bed, I examined myself in the bathroom mirror. Despite the shower and the food, I was wrecked. I had dark circles under my eyes. I'd lost weight. I really did look like a waif who needed to be rescued. It was wonderful to sleep in a real bed instead of under a bridge. I missed Garth, though. Each night I was inside that bedroom. They locked my door. And they took care that during my waking hours, I was never alone. The next couple of days were spent in getting my Aunt Dove papers ready. I had my picture and fingerprints taken so they could make me a passport. The passport was certified at the Gilead Embassy in Ottawa, then sent back to the consulate by special courier. They'd put in Aunt Dove's identifying numbers, but with my picture and physical data, and they'd even infiltrated the Canadian Immigration Database, where Aunt Dove had been recorded coming in, removed the real Aunt Dove from it temporarily, and posted my own data plus my iris scan and thumbprint.
We have many friends inside the Canadian government infrastructure, said Aunt Beatrice. You'd be amazed. So many well-wishers, said Aunt Dove.
Then both of them said,
Praise be.
They'd put an embossed stamp on one of the pages that said Pearl Girl. That meant I would be let into Gilead immediately, no questions asked. It was like being a diplomat, said Aunt Beatrice. Now I was Aunt Dove, but a different Aunt Dove. I had a Pearl Girls missionary temporary Canadian visa that I had to give back to the border authorities when exiting. It was simple, said Aunt Beatrice.
Look down a lot when we're going through, said Aunt Dove.
It hides the features. Anyway, it's the modest thing to do.
Aunt Beatrice and I were driven to the airport in a black Gilead government car, and I passed border control with no trouble. We didn't even get body searched. The plane was a private jet. It had an eye with wings on it. It was silver, but it looked dark to me, like a huge dark bird, waiting to fly me where? Into a blank. Ada and Elijah had tried to teach me as much as possible about Gilead. I'd seen the documentaries and the TV footage, but I still could not picture what might be waiting for me there. I didn't feel ready for this at all. I remembered Sanctuaire and the women refugees. I'd looked at them, but I hadn't really seen them. I hadn't considered what it was like to leave a place you knew and lose everything and travel into the unknown. How hollow and dark that must feel, except for maybe the little glimmer of hope that had allowed you to take such a chance. Very soon I, too, was going to feel like that. I would be in a dark place, carrying a tiny spark of light, trying to find my way. Chapter 45. We were late taking off, and I worried that I had been found out and we would be stopped after all. But once we were in the air, I felt lighter. I'd never been in a plane before. I was very excited at first.